Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey guys, it's Candace
and Kayla, and we are directionally challenged.
Yep, we thought we'd have it all figured out by the time we're in our 30s.
But surprise, we don't.
No, we don't. But that's okay.
It is okay. It is absolutely okay. Today, we are sitting down with two fascinating beings. The first, Paul Holes, recently retired as a cold case investigator after spending more than 27 years working for the sheriff and district attorney's offices. Paul has an extensive experience applying investigative, behavioral, and forensic techniques in notable cases such as Zodiac, Golden State Killer, Lacey Peterson, and J.C. Dugard. As an FBI task force officer, he teamed with FBI personnel, recently completed a 24-year pursuit by leading a small team using innovative technology, then identified Joseph DeAngelo as the main suspect in the case of the Golden State Killer, the most prolific and cunning serial predator in American history. We're also joined by Billy Jensen. He's a true crime journalist focused squarely on unsolved murders and missing persons. But after 17 years of writing hundreds of stories with no endings, he was fed up and decided to try and solve murders himself using radical social media techniques, and it worked. They both have a podcast called Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad. Without further ado, here is our conversation with Paul Holes and Billy Jensen.
All right, and we are here with Paul Holes and Billy Jensen. Thank you guys so much for joining us. I just want to jump right in with the question I'm sure you guys get every single day. Why are we so obsessed with true crime, especially as women? Like, I know that men are also obsessed, but women in particular are obsessed with true crime. I mean, there's a crime con.
Yes.
That's insane.
I think I have been asked this a lot, and I have thought about this a lot. And it very much is. I mean, if you take a look at our listenership, it probably is 90% female. It's very much, you know, females are so much more in tune with the human condition and trying to figure things out. Guys are pretty dopey when it comes down to it. And they're just sort of like, you know, they don't, you know, we were in the most recent episode, we were talking about this letter that we didn't know if a girl or a boy wrote it because they were in high school or college. And it was obvious that a woman wrote it because of all the details that she provided. And it was just, I think women are so much more attuned to that kind of thing. And yes, that's always going to be a generalization. And they're more attuned to, you know, trying to create some sort of order out of chaos, which is what true crime ultimately, I think that's the root of it, at least for me, at least. It's just bad things happen, but hopefully there'll be a good resolution at the end of the day.
Yeah, you know, and I know in my experience, when you take a look at the cases that seem to be popular within the true crime space, you know, during the course of my law enforcement career, I went out on more gangbang homicides than anything else. But how many podcasts, how many shows focus in on that type of story? I think because of the types of crimes that true crime focuses in on, oftentimes women are the victims. And of course, they're wanting to pay attention to, well, what happened to that person and how can I avoid that happening to me? And then like Billy's saying is, I think women do have that emotional connection. You know, they have the emotional connection, the empathy to what happened to that victim, but they also can extrapolate that towards their own lives or somebody else that they know. And I know for me, I mean, I got into true crime as a young kid. You know, I was watching the TV show Quincy, and then I made a career out of it. And so it's natural. You know, it's one of those things where this is part of human nature that we deal with, and we want to try to prevent it from happening. But when it does happen, well, what is the story behind it? And what ultimately caused it? And how can we avoid this happening to somebody we love?
And, you know, so many of us are obsessed with it, but you guys take it a step further and make it your career. You are the ones who live the real life movies. And to us, it seems a bit fantastical and so interesting and just kind of like your day-to-day life is like a real movie. What took you from being the kind of people that watched it as a TV show or read it and then began to live it? What made you make that choice as a career?
I learned very early on that I didn't, you know, I was always, a true crime person, but I learned very early on in my journalistic career that I didn't want to write about stories that were solved. I felt like it felt very sort of exploitative when I remember going out on a story for the New York Post, and I hated it. So I said, I just want to do stuff that's unsolved. And that meant that you can't be a reporter then and just say I'd only do unsolved. So I had to become an editor and run the newspapers and magazines, but then do the stuff on the side. And, you know, for 17 years, I wrote stories with no endings, it doesn't matter how great of a writer that you are, when you're writing a story with no ending, it's a bummer. And not to mention the fact that you're constantly talking to victims' families and trying to get them help. And I just got completely fed up with it. I saw a video on YouTube about a guy getting attacked in the street, and he gets attacked, and then a guy punches him, and then a cab actually drives over his body and kills him. And there was tremendous video. It was great looking video. And I was like, why hasn't anybody caught him? And I just decided right then and there, I'm gonna find out who this guy is myself. And using social media and a bunch of different things, I was able to do that. And that's how I veered off into this part of my career.
Yeah. And, you know, I know for me, growing up, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had an aptitude for science, and I pursued, you know, I thought I was going to go to med school. And in part, it was because I had seen the TV show Quincy, who was a forensic pathologist. And I thought, oh, I'm going to become a Quincy. Yeah. And thank God I didn't, because I couldn't imagine having a career where all I'm doing is standing in a morgue, cutting on bodies day in and day out for years. But then I found the field related to forensic science, criminalistics out in California, and finding out, oh, these are people who go out to crime scenes, and they get to do the science and work with investigators. And I was super excited about that. But once I started doing the science, I started recognizing that, well, I'm removed from the cases. I'm in the lab. And I liked the crime scene aspect. I liked being out there in the middle of the night and dealing with the victims and dealing with the physical evidence and talking to the investigators and watching the witnesses come up to the crime scene tape saying, hey, I saw something. And then I started recognizing in myself, oh, I'm much more investigatively focused than lab focused. And I ended up gearing towards that. And like Billy, this is, you know, Billy and I are the odd couple in many ways, but we're very similar in how we look at cases, because for me, it was the unsolved case. It was the cold case that caught my attention. Why is that case unsolved? And, you know, I think in many ways, there's an ego in me going, well, the previous people couldn't solve it, but I can solve it. And so that's what I started doing. And I quickly found out that the serial predator and the behaviors that the serial predator did was my fascination. And so that became my skill set. You know, I started digging into that in 1994. And the very first case I dug into was the East Area Rapist, who later became known as the Golden State Killer. But then over the course of, 25 years, I focused in on cases in which women and children were victims. And most of those cases are predatory type cases. And so I kind of developed my own niche. And so that's where Billy and I are very similar. He recognized his skill sets in the unsolved space. And so did I. And now here you go. You know, we've got the murder squad. And Billy and I come at it from our own perspectives.
Well, I can imagine that there's a period in time, like pre-internet, pre-cell phones, you know, pre-social media, where it really was just up to law enforcement, anyone who was working the case. You know, it would be a very difficult job to try to be a civilian and trying to like crack a cold case. Whereas now there are full chat rooms and groups and people who are able to dedicate all their working hours outside of their day-to-day jobs to cracking cold cases. Do you feel like this has been a help, like a huge help, in order to solve cold cases, or has it now kind of made it really noisy? I mean, obviously in certain cases we've seen it help, in the long run, but how have you guys seen that kind of transpire over the last decade or so?
You know, I think it definitely has helped. Anytime that you can shine more light on cases. Listen, since 1980, there's 230,000 unsolved murders, okay, in America. The internet was around, you know, between 1980 and 1990. The only time you would ever hear about these cold cases is if they were featured on a local television station, a local newspaper, and then that was it. You didn't have this. So you know, the idea that podcasts are taking cases that nobody's ever heard about, that's always going to help. It's going to, anytime that you can take a story out of the darkness and put it into light, it's going to help. You know, one of the things that has hurt though is that the resources of, you know, to get it from the chat room into the TV station and the newspaper, those resources are dwindling because we have a lot less people in the newsrooms than we had 10 years ago. Mm. So podcasts are kind of picking up that slack a little bit. And so is social media. People, you know, create social media pages for specific cases or for overall cases or whatever. And, but it's, there's less of a chance now that if you put somebody like the way America's Most Wanted was back in the day, pre-internet, when everybody was watching it. And if you put a guy up there that you were looking for, you know, there was odds are people were going to find him. Media's gotten so fragmented now, and there's so few reporters out there now that are actually getting paid a living wage, that it's tough. So these other resources have to kind of pick it up.
Mm-hmm. You know, and there's no question that I think having the public attention on these unsolved cases is huge. Where law enforcement needs to catch up, and I've experienced this firsthand, is now with the online resources and those people that are deciding that they're going to become, you know, these online sleuths, is that the volume of information coming into law enforcement can be overwhelming. And law enforcement needs to adapt to that, because what typically happens is that if somebody emails into the agency or calls in and says, I'm talking about Zodiac, right? Okay, well, so-and-so is assigned Zodiac. So that detective ends up fielding all this information that's coming in. And this is a person that gets very quickly overwhelmed, because when you get 30 tips a day, and that's what I was experiencing on Golden State Killer, it's like, well, where do I start with that? I have no way to filter that. I will spend my entire day just working all these phone tips. And then the next day, I'm going to have new tips coming in. So that's something where law enforcement needs to catch up with the modern day. But having that public attention, you know, that's where law enforcement has to get better, both at releasing pertinent information to help solve the case. So the public can go, yeah, if somebody out there goes, I know something, or I have a special skill set, I can contribute to this case. And law enforcement just does a poor job at that at this point in time. You know, public agencies are typically, you know, we're a good decade behind technology-wise, as well as culturally and socially. It's just the nature of the business that we're in. Yeah. But we will get there.
I can't tell you how many times, like, you know, there were certain law enforcement agencies that weren't able to get on social media 5 years ago. They get the worst computers, you know, which is that sort of thing. And when you look at, you know, police budgets and things, it's, I always say, all these journalists that are out of work, hire them at the police departments to be taking in these tips, because they're very good at it. They've been doing it all of their lives, taking in tips, and then they can separate the wheat from the chaff. You know, you could utilize the skill sets of each person in there. You know, we just have a long way to go in terms of how we can potentially, you know, solve a lot of these cases.
Right. With so many unsolved cases still out there, how do you guys choose what cases to focus your episodes on?
It's difficult because there are so many, and we get probably 10 a day. I probably get 5 a day. I think Murder Squad gets 10 to 15 a day. Most of those are from listeners, but, you know, probably once a day we'll get one from a family member saying, you know, my son was shot, please help. And you wish you could do all of those. And I was just thinking about this last night. The biggest thing that I hate about a podcast blowing up or having a book and this and that is just that you can get, I don't have time to do everything, you know, and I really wish I did. And I really wish there was more organizations that could do it, because there are just so many people out there looking for answers. When you think about if there's that many unsolved murders, 15,000 every year, 230,000 since 1980, you know, there's a lot of people that are out there looking for answers, and that doesn't even count the missing persons that are out there. So, you know, we pick them based on whether we think there is a probability that there's something out there that there might be a clue in order to, that somebody can latch onto, that could push, you know, we're always going to be looking for a solve, but we at least want to push the investigation forward somehow, some way, even if it's a little building block onto the next one. That's what we want to do. So those are the ones that we look for.
Do you focus mainly on serial killers? Because Paul, I know that's what you said your specialty was as well.
Well, for Murder Squad, no. You know, we do a quite a variety of different types of cases, you know, but typically there is some unsolved aspect of the case that we highlight, in which we give the assignments to our listeners. Hey, here's the summary of this case. And then, hey, listeners, you know, this is what we think coming from our perspective is what law enforcement could use, whether it's to identify the offender, or, like, you know, we've done several cases in which we've had killers that are photographers, and now there's these photographs of potential victims. Can you identify the victim? We know who the killer is. Is this person a victim, or is this somebody who just happened to be photographed by the person? So it's really just giving the online community a focus, you know, coming from our perspective. Yeah. And I think that's been very beneficial, you know, coming out of law enforcement and dealing with the online sleuths when there is no control. That's where you're getting, you know, pulled in so many different directions, because these people are going their own way. But Billy and I can take a look at a case, and working with Polly, we can kind of say, okay, this is sort of the focus on which this case needs from our listeners. And that's where the weekly assignments that typically Billy is reading, you know, goes out to our listeners. And so we try to focus this crowdsource aspect. And I think it's proven to be very beneficial doing that.
Yeah. You know, like Paul was talking about, we did a four-part season opener called Can I Take Your Picture? And it's about the serial killers that use the ruse of being a photographer in order to kill their victims. And one of them was Rodney Alcala, who is the Dating Game killer. Billy Bradford was another one. Joe Nasa was another one. And there were these gentlemen that when you arrest them and go through all their stuff, you find tons and tons of photographs. They put those out and they try to figure out who they are. Some of them are actually women that have been murdered, that they haven't been able to find out who they murdered. And they figured out this guy murdered him. But then there's other victims that are out there. Even with Billy Bradford, they found so many of the photos, they finally released them. People took a look and they put up a, 55 pictures. Sure enough, one of the women on the pictures was actually murdered and was definitely murdered by Bradford. There was 17 that we didn't know who they were. We were able to identify a couple of them and just move the investigation forward. Anything that can lighten the load a little bit. We identified some of them in Alcala's pictures as well. And, these people were taking pictures not only in Southern California, but everywhere. And that's just an example of seeing a case and thinking, all right, well, if we could find this one clue, or if we knew this one thing, what would we be able to do with it? And it's even things like if it's DNA, and we've offered to, if people have DNA from a murder scene that they can't afford to process, this morning we gave about $2,500 to the Breonna Maitland case for them to run DNA based around that case. And she's a woman that went missing up in New England, in the mountains of New England. And it's a pretty famous case. And they were stuck. They were trying to do crowdfunding, but they were stuck at $2,500. And we did a story on it. We said, you know what, we'll make up the difference and let's go do it. But now we're going to be watching you like a hawk and you better go do it.
Yeah, I just want to touch upon what Billy was talking about with the Can I Take a Picture? I mean, Candace and Kayla, you both are in the Hollywood scene. You guys have had headshots done. You've probably have met with, different photographers, different videographers. You could see where somebody, a predator, could pose in this environment, and they've got all these beautiful women that are just voluntarily, you want to go out in the desert and take a really cool shot out there, right? And now you're isolated. So I think you guys can most certainly empathize with those victims, because here they were just pursuing their life dreams, and a predator took advantage of that.
I think that what you were saying at the beginning of our conversation of wanting to create order in chaos, that I think I can find myself drawn to true crime in ways because it makes me feel like I can prevent it from happening. Exactly like what you said. Like I remember when my last pregnancy, it was a huge anniversary for the JonBenet murder, and I became obsessed. I watched everything. I went deep dives. Looking at photos that even now I would feel uncomfortable looking at from the crime scene. And I was just so confused by why I was doing this. I was like very pregnant with a little girl. And here I am, just cannot take my eyes away from this horrifying case.
It's almost the equivalent of nesting. You're almost fortifying in your head your castle. You're trying to figure out any ways and any bad things that could happen. And that is we know that the JonBenet case is one of the ultimate tragic locked door mysteries that we have in true crime. And everybody tries to make sense of it. And that I can understand that makes sense of a mother to be, or mothers in general, wanting to try and figure out that case. So, because, you have a baby on the way or a baby in the house.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of on along those lines, but maybe taking a 180 degree spin on it is, my wife was working in the field responding out to crime scenes and saw some horrific things. And then she had her first child and she's going, I can't do that. I can't look at that anymore. And here I have four kids. And, I'm still to this day reviewing cases in which kids have been killed. And it becomes different when you have that personal life experience, that now that empathy comes in. You're a mom. You know what it would mean to lose your child. And now you're seeing a case or hearing about a case in which a mom has lost their child. You know, that's where even at CrimeCon, you know, it's we emphasize this is real life and these are real victims and these are real emotions and real people lost their lives or lost their loved ones. And that's what we want to continue to push is even though people gravitate towards this to hear about it and hear the stories, there's real people behind those stories. And we can't ever forget that.
Paul and Billy, how do you guys process and compartmentalize your work? Because you do have to turn it off at some point, or does it just constantly stay in your head and ideas come? Are there moments where you can just do something as simple as cook and not think about these details of the cases?
I don't cook. No, I try to do things that are, you know, take my mind off of it. It was fun to be able to go to Universal Studios, which is right around the corner from me, and go to Hogwarts and lose myself there for 2 hours. Can't do that right now. Or go to Disney or you know, smoke a joint and look at some Viewmaster reels, you know, just anything that's like that. And then, you know, exercising and binging Schitt's Creek. And, you know, it's you know, things I'm able to get out of it to a certain extent, unless I'm like deep into a project. I'm writing my second book now, and I'm also working on this Long Island serial killer case. So it's just like, you know, this is really the first time, the first year in my entire career that I've done true crime really, really for my day job and my night job. I've always had to be a digital executive, or I had to be a newspaper editor or I ran a bunch of different newspaper websites, but this is the first time. So I can't really get away from it, but I can turn it off every now and again with some silliness. And that's usually what I try to do. Or I can play hockey, which is another thing I can't do right now.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's true. You know, I know for me, it's ever present, you know, and that's where, you know, the problem comes in. You know, that's where, you know, you go and you maybe drink a little bit too much, try to just relax in a way to where it's not just constantly there. And I probably could use, you know, more hobbies now that I'm, you know, in this beautiful state of Colorado. I'm getting out into nature more and that helps. But, you know, it's something that in some ways you I know for me, and I'm in the process of getting a book written and talking to my author and trying to expose my inner thoughts. You know, it's almost like a therapy session. You know, for me, I do what I'm good at. And I constantly, when I find that I'm not working cases, that there's something missing in my life. And so I find that I'm constantly going back into that space for everything that it entails. But there is a weird enjoyment. You know, it's one of those things. It's like, for me, if you sit down, I used to, when I would read novels, I mean, I would be tunnel visioned and there'd be that euphoria of learning the story. When I get involved in a case, it's tunnel visioned and there's that euphoria of learning the details of the case. So there is an adrenaline rush associated with it, but it comes with consequences, you know, and that's where even at this age, I'm starting to recognize there is a life, there's a career of consequences that I'm now dealing with, and I just have to kind of get through it. And I'm not entirely sure that I figured out how to get through it, but I'm just doing the best I can. You know, and part of it is, you know, what Billy and I are doing. It's keeping me engaged, you know, and so that's healthy. That's cathartic in some ways.
Well, there are a lot of hard days that you guys have, but there are also some really, I'm sure, like gratifying days. The Golden State Killer was caught this year in jail, prison forever. On days like that, how does it feel? What are all the emotions? Because I'm sure there's a gambit of them.
Yeah. You bring up, like, Golden State Killer is a is a different beast entirely as a case for me. Because there's no question, the fact that D'Angelo was identified and caught and now he is sentenced, you know, that is a positive. For me, I found going through, you know, I was at, you know, both the plea hearing as well as the sentencing, that it wasn't celebratory. It was very different, a very different space than what I was expecting. You know, and maybe to compare and contrast, I was pointing out, you know, I've got, you know, the image of, you know, the D'Angelo team, the genealogy team that caught D'Angelo on one side of me. And then I've got this NorCal rapist courtroom sketches. NorCal rapist, Roy Waller being caught. It's a case I got involved with in 1996. There is a celebratory aspect to that. But for whatever reason, Golden State Killer and D'Angelo, and I think it's because I got so close to so many of the victims, and then I saw firsthand that even though he's been identified, he's caught, he's never going to get out again, these victims are still struggling, that it was a very subdued experience for me. And even though it was like, okay, yeah, he's not going to get out, it's sort of like, well, you know what? Even at this point in time, and this guy has been sentenced to the rest of his life in prison, nobody has won. You know, everybody loses in this type of situation. And it's just sort of, you know, it's not that rah-rah, you know, that you would think. We had the rah-rah. You know, I was at SAC Homicide when D'Angelo was taken in custody, and we're listening on the radio. And, you know, when hearing the commander of the arrest team say, the subject in custody, we're all, high-fiving and it's rah-rah. That was a celebration. And then it's that experience of seeing the echoes and the ramifications of what this guy did over the course of decades, that it's just like, it's not what I thought it would be. And it's just, you know, hopefully we have other cases that we can celebrate about.
No, definitely. I'll tell you, you know, having done it for 17 years, I was working on that one case and with Mr. Gaines, Marcus Gaines, who was struck and attacked in Chicago. When I got the phone call from his sister that she said, you know, because I was able to identify him, then we were trying to track him down. I was begging the police. I said, he was in Minnesota. This guy's in Minnesota. You got to go get him. They finally did get him after 6 months. And there was an elation there. There was a fist pump there when she called up and she said, we got him. And then it just, I can't tell you what happened. It just all completely just wiped away. And then it just became sadness, because it's almost like you want to share the story with the victim and be like, how we did it. And it's just, it became a very kind of empty feeling, and it just became of, all right, well, you know, there's so much more to do. GSK was just such a surreal feeling. I mean, obviously Paul knew what was going on with me. You know, we had just helped put out the book, Michelle McNamara's book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. We had just had a book event with myself and Gillian Flynn, who wrote the foreword, and Patton Oswalt, her husband, and Paul Haynes, her researcher. We were all in the same room for the first time together. We were in Chicago, her hometown. And then to find out that news that night, and it was also the first night that we were filming the HBO doc, was just such an incredibly surreal moment. And the whole week was surreal, to be honest with you. And the next day, I remember being at the airport with Patton. We were flying back to New York, and he was just like, if I wake up in an hour and I'm still in the hotel and this was all a dream, I'm going to be really pissed off. Because that's really what it felt like. I've never felt anything like that before, that just surreal moment, because I really did feel like I was in a dream.
Well, the synergy of it all too, happening simultaneously, the day, first day you're shooting the documentary, all of that. It's almost like it was just meant to be as a tribute to Michelle as well.
It was crazy. There was so much more that happened that night that I wish that they would have, you know, I know that with the, you know, editing and everything, they couldn't show it, but there'd be an amazing behind the scenes type of thing about what was going on that night and everything. And just trying to figure, I write about it in my book too, just like trying to figure out who this guy is, and doing newspapers.com. And once I saw the newspapers.com article about him being arrested for as a cop, stealing a dog repellent and a hammer, it was like, this is the guy, you know, and just coming sort of face to face with him. It was just, it was an incredible, incredible feeling.
Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It's time to get more in 2024. I know for me, one of my goals is to feel really strong this year. And honestly, so far, so good. Because that's where 310 Nutrition comes in. It's helping me and our listeners in the new year with protein and super rich food products with so many options and flavors. Right now I have the Chocolate Bliss and Caramel Sundae, and they are both so delicious. I have to hide them from my husband so that he doesn't steal them too. They're a triplex protein blend, plant-based proteins that include pea, brown rice, and pumpkin that leave me feeling full. 310 Nutrition also has a hydrate electrolyte drink mix. My favorite is the peach mango flavor. So not only am I hydrating and drinking water, I have an electrolyte blend, vitamin blend, and it's sugar-free. With one stick of hydrate mix into 16 ounces of water, and it can provide the same amount of hydration equal to drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. Thank you. This way I can keep my resolution, keep feeling strong, have greater focus, feel refreshed, and maintain my hydration without having to drink as much. One of my favorite refreshing water enhancers they have is the lemonade flavor. It gives me energy. This one's also sugar-free. It's used with real lemons and it's pH balanced. And this also offers the same hydration as 2 to 3 bottles of water. Right now, 310 is celebrating a new year of goals with code CHALLENGED and giving our listeners 50% off up to $100 for your first order. With so many sample packs, new products, it's really fun and easy to put together an order or start a subscription on products that you know you'll use and will help you keep your resolution. So go to 310nutrition.com and use the code CHALLENGED right now for 50% up to $100 for your first order. That's 310-nutrition.com and use code CHALLENGED. It's all the good stuff your body needs in flavors you crave. So be healthier effortlessly. And we're back.
How do you guys stay committed to a case for so long? Because as you said, I mean, Paul, I think you were referring to, you know, court sketches that the case started in 1996. How do you continually stay committed and inspired to solve a case for so long?
You know, for me, I mean, whether it be a Golden State Killer, whether it be NorCal rapist or other cases in my career, it's always in, you know, you're working in spurts. It's so even though I was involved with GSK for over 24 years, it was in where I was heavily involved. And then I had other things I was dealing with. And then I would circle back around to it. And it was a variety of circumstances. With GSK, it most certainly was the magnitude of the case. And then eventually it got to where I ended up developing personal relationships with some of the victims. And then I was like, I'm obligated at this point. Okay. With other cases, you know, there's this one case I desperately want to solve, this 1970 homicide of Cassette Ellison. I've got my binder up above me, you know, and for me, it's a personal connection to the victim. I look at Cassette's photograph and she was just the cutest 15-year-old girl. And there's just something about her that just captured my heart. And it's like, I got to keep coming back to it. I can't. No investigator can stay on a case for two decades straight. But the persistence of the willingness to revisit the case, maybe you go 6 months, maybe you go a year. With GSK, I probably went years at one point without doing any work on the case. But it's having that something that motivates you internally. And it typically for me has been that personal connection. And that personal connection could be victim driven. It could be because of the time I've spent on the case before. You know, and I think there's also the, you know what, I don't want to be defeated. You know, there's that aspect. You know, I feel that I can do this. I want to get back on it.
It was interesting. I actually, just reading through your bio, I was like, oh yeah, JC Duggard. I haven't thought of that case in a really, really long time. And I was very young when she was kidnapped, and obviously she was kidnapped for a very long time, and just rereading through her case. When you have cases that have been solved and you look back on them, you know, when I was rereading through the JC Duggard case, it was seeing that there was a section of missed rescue opportunities. Is it hard to look back on a case and see all the dots start to connect and that kind of frustration? Or, I mean, there's also only, I understand that there's an element of that it led you to the case being solved at some point, but it just made me wonder that of like recognizing missed opportunities, like do those kind of stay with you, or are those teachable moments for the next case?
Well, I think, you know, when you start taking a look at some of these cases, and JC's case obviously is an interesting case where a young girl abducted out of the Tahoe area and was in, you know, basically her offender, Phil Garrido, and Nancy Garrido, the wife, they both were involved in this.
Yeah.
You know, they're in my jurisdiction for almost 20 years before we knew that JC had been living, you know, in our area. I know when I initially got involved in that case, there was a lot of controversy about how could this little girl, this abducted girl, have been in our midst all this time, us not know it. And knowing that we even had one of the deputies from my department go out to Garrido's house and say, there's nothing here, you know, and then seeing my sheriff, you know, throw that guy under the bus. And he was a very good deputy, but it just had to do with the circumstances of the property and how he didn't know that the 2 acres behind the fence line also belonged to Garrido. And that's where JC and her kids were being kept. That, you know, there's a learning aspect to it. I know for me, like in particular that case, and I spent 2 weeks on Garrido's property, both for an unsolved series out of the Contra Costa area, as well as 2 missing girls out of the Alameda County area. It's more of what else has he done? I can take a look at JC's case and go, okay, yeah, there were some misses, you know, on parole side or probation or law enforcement side in that. But for me, it's like, I got this offender who we know he's abducted a girl. He's fathered two children with his this underage victim. You know, he's raised her on this property, and he's had other cases that we know about. Who else has he hurt? And so that's more my focus, is I'm now looking, okay, what other cases can be solved now that we know who this offender is, that we know about this offender?
Yeah.
Like the photographers.
Like the photographers, exactly. And that was the first that, you know, after that sort of elation and the surreal nature of GSK, my first thought was make a timeline and figure out where this guy was and what other cases might he be involved in. Because that's the one thing you never, ever sit back and say, ah, that's it. You know, you don't even, maybe you can have one drink and relish in it, but there's always going to be literally 1,000 or more cases that are sitting on your desk.
Right. And, you know, we started this talking about why are we as women so obsessed with true crime? And, you know, we talked about how it was us wanting to try and solve it, figure it out, make sure we are never in a situation like that. I want to make sure we touch on what are some personality traits and some red flags that our listeners can kind of be aware of to make sure that they are never in a situation like that.
In a situation around a like a sociopath or a psychopath or somebody.
Correct.
That, yeah. Okay. They might be actors. As you know, my other podcast, The First Degree, that's what because they both dated actors, and they always bring that up.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's definitely those narcissistic tendencies are a thing, you know, and then a lack of empathy. You know, I think if you go, those are sort of my biggest things when I look at it and to take a look at that. I don't know if you've ever read like the psychopath test or anything. It's interesting how they show that, like, you know, a lot of CEOs and a lot of politicians very well might be, because you have to, in order to put yourself in those situations, you can't have, it's almost a, you know, you need empathy in those positions, but you need to kind of turn it off because I think you might go crazy. But if you're just a regular guy or an actor or something along those lines, there's something there if you can identify someone like, you know, a Bundy or somebody like that that has those narcissistic tendencies. Now, that doesn't mean that there are other people out there. You know, we always look at Bundy because Bundy's the guy that was attractive and successful and educated and charming, and say like, wow, any girl could have fallen for that guy. But there are also a lot of serial killers out there, and the majority of serial killers out there are not like that. They are guys that are picking up sex workers or you know, taking their lives under the cloak of the opioid epidemic. That's one of the things that I'm working on now. It's the idea of that sort of Bundy guy that's going to, you know, that's a kind of a one-off too. I think the guy, you know, in terms of like, yeah, Bundy got away with it for so long. Would a guy like Chris Watts have kept going? You know, another guy that when you watch him, you can just tell by the body mannerisms that he was lying. You know, watch that video again, the way that he's holding his hands around his body, like he's trying to make sure that nobody cracks open his secrets. And I think that, you know, identifying those traits, and Paul, you've got some thoughts on this as well, but I think it comes down to narcissistic qualities and lack of empathy.
You know, and it really comes down to, and I would highly recommend, you know, listening to or paying attention to a British profiler by the name of Laura Richards. She's heavy into, you know, this abusive relationship between men and women and how women ultimately become victims. And one of those aspects that you see over and over again is this coercive control that guys, whether it be in a very early dating type of relationship or in an established marriage, where the guy is now trying to take control over his partner. And it could be very subtle or it could be very obvious. I mean, obvious jealousy, obviously flying into a rage if his wife or girlfriend is talking to another guy. Stalking behaviors. You know, these are red flags that if somebody is doing those during the course, whether it be the beginning of the relationship or even in an established marriage, that those are something that the woman needs to pay attention to, because that is one of those indicators that this person could escalate to violence because of the emotional aspect that they are following. They don't want this woman to be talking to somebody else, and you don't talk to that guy or I'm going to hurt you. You know, so looking for the coercive control aspect, I think, is huge. You know, and like Billy's saying, when you start getting into the predatory aspect, where now you're starting to escalate to where is this somebody that is going to routinely be hurting women? You know, narcissistic personalities are definitely there. You know, when I've talked to like citizens academies, you know, and I'll have the women, well, how do we, you know, what do we do if we're confronted by somebody, you know, and it's one of those things where it's like, well, you know, I'm not a survivalist. I'm not somebody that's going to be talking about, you know, how your, you know, situational awareness. There are experts on that. But what I can tell you is that when you are dealing with somebody that is going to hurt you, you always fight. You always have to fight back. And I've pointed out behind me, you know, Golden State Killer, D'Angelo versus NorCal rapist, Roy Waller, two very different offenders. When you have somebody like a Roy Waller, who is what I classify as a power reassurance type of rapist, he is somebody that likes to lay next to his victim and stroke her hair and whisper sweet nothings into her ear. You know, it's like a consensual relationship. He is somebody, if you punch him or you fight back when he's attacking you, he's going to run off. Versus a D'Angelo, this power assertive or anger retaliatory type of offender, he's somebody that's going to amp up on you, but you still fight him. But if you run into somebody who's a sexual sadist, you fight him. But if you see him or feel him getting more and more excited because you're fighting him and you're screaming, try the opposite tactic. Try just going limp, because this particular type of offender gets off on the fear that he is inflicting and gets more excited the more you fight him. And so there are examples of women who have been attacked by a sexual sadist and they recognize I'm dead and they just go limp. And then that offender just pushes away and walks off because they're not getting what they want. But my fundamental thing is if you are being physically attacked, you always fight until you realize I'm not going to win this, and this guy seems to be amping up. Then try the opposite tactic. And if that doesn't seem to be working, then you re-engage and you fight again. You know, because you just have to keep fighting him.
I'm just really grateful for that. Thank you.
I froze because for a second.
No, it's fine. I just feel like that is something that's such hugely beneficial information, and I personally did not know that. So I'm sure there are a lot of people listening that will benefit from having that at some point. So thank you for sharing that.
Well, it's really, you know, that's just what the general layperson doesn't understand the behaviors of the offenders and the motivations of the offenders. And you can get into the fine weeds, but fundamentally is you fight for your life until you recognize that that's not working. Try the opposite. If that doesn't work, then you re-engage and you fight for your life. That's what you can do. I've got a couple of daughters, you know, and I've told them, you know, you get somebody who grabs you, I mean, you fight for your life. You do not get into their car. I don't care if they've got a gun or a knife, because what's going to happen to you after they get you into the car is going to be far worse than being shot or stabbed right there on the sidewalk.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You guys talk about on your podcast getting loud. And how citizens can reach out to you with cases that they want solved. And I know you get a lot every day, like you had said, Billy, you guys get multiple cases. How can they reach out to you if this is something that they truly feel needs to be solved? If it's a loved one or what, how can they reach out to you? What's the best way to do that?
The best way to reach out to us is to go to themurdersquad.com, but you know, and send us that information. There's a contact button right there, or contact us over social media. But really, the getting loud is we really started it for victims' families, and whenever victims' family, it's just call every day. You know, they stop, you know, the squeaky wheel does get the grease when it comes to things in law enforcement. It really does. And you might think you're being a pain in the ass, but you often have to. You shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to do that. But really, that's where where getting loud comes from. And then if it's a case that you really are interested in, either we might cover it, we might not cover it. But if you really want to devote yourself to it, you can start a Facebook page for it. You can start trying to gather information that way. The thing that I always tell people is that this is not for the faint of heart, and this is not a one-year commitment. When you're involved in a case and you start talking to family members, you're going to be doing it for the rest of your life. I have a case, Jennifer Wilmer, who went missing 30 years ago. I did the story 20 years ago, and we just did the story again on Murder Squad. There's a picture of her in the original story that I wrote back in 2002 of her holding this little girl at the beach. 20 years later, that little girl contacts me and says, "Hey, I'm the little girl in that picture, and she's a grown adult and just got married. You know, I'm still looking for information. Her mother had died. My aunt had died. It was her niece. My aunt had passed away. Do you know anything?" So it doesn't end. It's like, you know, I tell people, it's a commitment. Like, I remember going and adopting a dog at the ASPCA when I was a kid, and the sign above it said, are you really ready for this 15-year commitment? And the thing that I tell people, if you really are going to start some sort of social media campaign for a missing person or an unsolved murder, are you really ready for a lifelong commitment?
Well, I would kick myself. We could keep talking to you guys all night. We really could. And so I'm going to do you guys a favor and put like an end to this before I just keep talking your ears off. But I would kick myself if I didn't ask, because my husband and I debate this all the time. But I don't know if you guys are have read up on or watched the docuseries about the staircase murders with Michael Peterson.
Sure.
Paul's laughing really hard. Wait, why is this a funny
because
case?
I think the owl theory is something to think of. And my husband thinks I'm ridiculous for believing in the owl theory. But there were feathers, right? There were feathers.
Paul, me and Paul are of the same mind in this. But Paul, you want to take on the owl theory?
I feel like Candace. Chris hates this question.
Oh, is my husband going to win this argument?
There are questions that come up, but the owl theory is one of them that is, yeah.
Well, you know, okay, so to be fair.
My husband's going to be so happy he wins. Damn it. Oh.
Right. And I remember I was sitting, I was literally sipping bourbon, watching, I think, you know, I had the TV on, and then there was like this promo for The Staircase, and I'd never heard of the case before. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where, you know, I think, I was hearing there was a lot of controversy swirling about what happened in this case. And, you know, is it homicide? Is it an accident? Did she fall down the stairs? And I'm sitting there for the first time looking at this case, and I'm just sipping bourbon, and they flash up some of the crime scene photos as well as some of the autopsy sketches. And I almost spit my bourbon out because it was so obvious to my eyes as to what happened. And it was like, why is there any controversy about this case at all? Eventually, we ended up doing, I think it was an episode with Karen in Georgia, yeah. You know, about the staircase. And it's one of those things where I know a little bit more about it. You know, I dug a little bit more into the physical evidence, the injuries and everything than all the other stuff regarding the story behind the case. And there is no question. This is a homicide case. This is as obvious as it gets. And it blows my mind, number one, that there was even at trial any issues. But number two, that in the true crime sphere, that this is so controversial. And then when I heard about the damn owl, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. Really?
And this is why I don't solve crimes. This is why I am not a good civilian crime solver.
and I think this is, and I've seen this happen in some other cases where what ultimately happens, you see snippets of information, whether they hear it or they see it, that the general public are listening to, but they don't have the experience or expertise to necessarily understand what they're looking at or what they're seeing. And now, boom, it just explodes into something that it's not. And that's where I kind of put the staircase. And the owl theory to me is probably one of the most, well, I hate to use this term, Candace, I'm sorry.
It's okay. My husband's going to be so happy.
It's one of the most asinine things I've ever heard. you really, this owl caused multiple blunt force lacerations to the back of the victim's head?
I'm from Florida. Animals get crazy. You know,
animals do get crazy.
I grew up with alligators.
I'm surprised it didn't happen at a convenience store.
Yeah, they do, but an owl didn't do this. An owl didn't cause her to fall down the stairs. The stairs didn't cause these lacerations. The stairs didn't cause all that blood spatter. And it's so
okay.
Obvious.
I just want to say that Paul is heavily involved in the owl lobby. I just want to say that.
I love owls.
Oh my God. This is so good. I love this so much.
I know.
You guys worked so tirelessly trying to solve these crimes. You had a huge win today, if we can call it that. Is there, and you've solved a case this morning?
Well, I don't think we solved it. I think we got loud. I think it was the case of Rebecca Gould. She was found, she actually went missing first, but they had found blood inside of a mobile home, and she was found on an embankment. And a lot of things were going on in this case. This case has been open for a really, really long time. It seems like it went cold. We did a two-parter and interviewed a lot of people for it. Polly, our producer, really dug into it. And we talked to a lot of people. And there's been a lot of other podcasts. There's a podcast called Hell and Gone that did it as well. And really set the groundwork. And that's it. It's just like, the question is, and this is what happens with, and I say that with like Up and Vantage and Tara Grinstead. If Payne doesn't do that, Payne Lizzie doesn't do that, does that case get solved? And I don't think it does. There are certain things where that's a matter of getting loud and getting it into the public consciousness that, it's this whole thing with Michelle writing the book, and Michelle actually passing away and seeing law enforcement be like, you know what, we should probably put some more resources behind this. That's what happens. And, the more that we can get away from, the more that we can do these cases that people don't quite know about and get loud with them, and the better it's going to be for justice, because law enforcement is going to say, all right, you know what, people are really looking at us now. This is a national story, and we better do something about it. And luckily that's, they pulled the trigger on this one and they made an arrest.
That's great. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us today. The Murder Squad in the house. Thank you guys. Obviously they can, our listeners can listen to your podcast wherever they listen to their podcasts. But where can they follow you guys personally on social media?
I can be followed at Billy Jensen, Jensen, on Instagram and Twitter. I am on TikTok, but only as a only for research purposes, because
I want to watch Billy do a TikTok dance.
I've actually thought of it, and I was just like, well, and there's a way, and we know that our Is there a way to solve murders with it and that sort of thing? And I still haven't figured it out yet. So if anybody has any ideas, just let me know.
Your old nickname was the Facebook detective. Now you're the TikTok detective.
The TikTok detective. Well, yeah. There actually is one for the Alyssa Turner Turney case. But yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, do a search for that one.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a variety of undercover social media accounts that nobody knows about, but ooh. I can be Billy. You probably know my handle.
I think it's at Paul Holes on Twitter and Twitter. At Paul.Holes on Instagram.
That's right. Those are the two platforms mm-hmm. that I will occasionally post to. I am not a, I don't do a lot of volume on social media, but I am there. So I every now and then I'll throw something out there.
Well, we have thoroughly enjoyed discussing this with you guys. Thank you for sharing so much information with us and joining us today. You're the best.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having us. We really do appreciate it.
Candace, do you still feel like you are on Team Owl?
No, but this is why I know that I would make a terrible civilian detective. Mm-hmm. Like, I watch CSI and I'm like the jerk in the room who's like, I have no idea who did it. Like, and I know it's formula. Like, I should be able to figure that out. I think what's really important to remember that Paul and Billy did such a good job reiterating is that these are real people. You know, these are real families, friends, loved ones, real lives that were lost. And I know that I can easily get swept up in just watching a series of episodes and unsolved murders and crime docus and get so wrapped up in the storyline that I forget the people at the heart of it. And so it was really powerful to hear their perspectives on all that and how they balance, you know, the chase and the
adrenaline
of solving the crime while also the deep, deep empathy they have for the crimes that were committed against these innocent people.
Right. And I also really appreciate the tips that they give us and they gave us to help protect ourselves and our friends and our listeners. So thank you, Paul and Billy, for all of your advice and for your tireless work to help get these bad guys off the streets. We're really grateful for all that you do. And if you guys know of a case that you think needs to be solved, make sure you contact them. We have all the information provided in the show notes. And thank you for listening to another great episode of Directly Challenged. We have another one coming up next week. We'll see you then.
Directionally Challenged is a production of Pineapple Productions.
Producer, Melissa DeMonts.
Edited by Katrina Henning.
Post-production sound by Chris Henry.
Music by Joe King.
And advertising partnership with Acast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.